Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. This is our weekly news roundup. We're going to discuss some of the top news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Jeff Spillane. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. Welcome, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Sean.
And joining us a little later will be Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim DeRuiter of the New Bedford Standard Times, and Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. So we're going to have a full show here, Jeff. Let's start with one of the most surprising stories of the week came out of the election in Sandwich. We were kind of surprised to see that a familiar name, Joe Vaudo, is back on the town planning board. Remind us who Joe is.
Sure, Sean. And this was very much a surprise. Joe Vaudo was the gentleman who owns Joe's Lobster Mart along the canal in Sandwich. And last year, he was convicted of receiving stolen oysters. He pleaded guilty to receiving these oysters, as well as failing to keep proper records for shellfish. And he was fined. He was voted off the planning board last year. He was an incumbent and lost re-election. And lo and behold, this year he finds himself back on the planning board. There was an uncontested race for the planning board seat, and he had a write-in campaign and won, to the surprise of many people in Sandwich. He had 38 write-in votes, and now the planning board will be convening at its next meeting in executive session to ask the Board of Selectmen to remove him from the board, given his past. Whether this will be successful or not, we don't know, because typically to be removed from a position to which you've been elected would require a recall. But once again, it was quite a surprise.
Yeah.
And bold move on his part.
I don't think it was on anybody's radars except for him and the people who went in and wrote him in. And there was certainly some surprise going into executive session. I wonder why this isn't being discussed in open session.
Yeah, that's interesting. But typically, when you talk about an issue with one of your board members or a personnel issue, that's fairly typical.
Yeah, could be difficult.
To
see what happens with the Board of Selectmen there. Well, let's talk about another candidate. This is one we previewed last week. It was Phyllis Sprout. She was a school committee member in Mashpee until she resigned, and then she was back on the ballot.
That's right. She resigned about a year ago. She was involved in what she called a meltdown at the Quashnet Elementary School in Mashpee. She was volunteering, helping a few children with their reading exercises, and she allegedly hit one of the children with a book and poked one of the little girls in the stomach. And she was forced to resign before a recall effort was started to remove her from office. And once again, to everyone's surprise, she launched a campaign for school committee again. And she did come in third place, but only 64 votes out of actually winning a seat on the school committee. There were two positions open. So it was quite a contentious race for school committee in Mashpee. And from what I understand, there were protesters protesting Mrs. Sprout at the polling place during the morning and in the afternoon. I wasn't there to see them, but I guess it was quite a scene.
I didn't see them when I voted in Mashpee either, but I do know that last week Ann Brennan from the Cape Cod Times was saying that the father of that little girl was expected to be out there to remind people about that.
Yes, he was, and he was one of the protesters, and he did have a large group with him.
Well, she did not get reelected. There were a lot there's a lot of election-related news this week, and we certainly can't tackle it all. Let's talk about a trial that the Cape Cod Times covered quite closely. It's a case that we've all followed for about the last 5 years since a woman by the name of Trudy Hall from Nantucket went missing in 2010.
Right. Last Friday, the jury did return a verdict in this trial. Trudy, 23 years old, from Nantucket, went missing in 2010. Her body was found 2 years later in the woods in East Falmouth. And Quizelle Wilson was found guilty in first-degree murder in the case. That would be last Friday, as well as guilty of assault and battery with a dangerous weapon and improper disposal of a body. The jury only deliberated 14 hours before they returned the verdict. And there was only 5 days of testimony. So he has been sentenced to life in prison at MCI Cedar Junction, which we all know is Walpole. Mm-hmm. And the key to this case was the cell phone signals that were found in the parking lot where Trudy's car was left at the West Barnstable commuter lot, as well as where her body was left in East Falmouth. And we're also reporting today in the Times that 1 week to the day after he was found guilty, that an appeal has already been filed. We'll probably be heard in about a year and a half, but the basis of the appeal is that there was not a written affidavit to seek these cell phone records.
So the cell phones indicated that his phone was near both of those locations.
That's right, as well as her phone.
Yeah, and it was I read all the stories related to the trial, and you just, you know, your heart breaks for, you know, her mother coming over from Nantucket.
Exactly.
Very moving testimony.
That's right. And you know, Trudy was also pregnant.
Yes, of course. Another kind of a shocker of a story this week is related to a Cape Cod bus driver.
Yes, this also happened last Friday, late afternoon. A bus driver, his name's Everett Redmond, he's 62 years old, of Brewster, was driving students from Cape Cod Technical High School in Harwich. This was not the regular after-school bus. This was the after-athletic event bus. So it was about 6 o'clock in the afternoon. One of the students on the bus noticed that the driver was acting erratically, driving erratically, and had the sense to pick up the cell phone and call her parents, who in turn called the state police. They did catch up with the bus at a Burger King parking lot in West Barnstable, and turned out that the driver was under the influence of alcohol. He failed sobriety tests and was charged with operating under the influence. It was his second charge, as well as child endangerment. At his arraignment on Monday, which I attended, he did speak with the media on the steps of the Barnstable District Courthouse and admitted that he had been drinking. Actually said that he had a tough week and the kids got to me and I had a couple drinks. Did say he was sorry, but did admit that he was drinking. And with the police reports that were available that day, it only went from bad to worse. He said that he, prior to getting behind the wheel of the bus, had 4 shots of vodka. When asked how big the shots were, he said they were pretty large. They were mouthfuls of vodka. And he also had a chaser of orange juice. And so one of the questions that came out of this, Sean, is Cape Destinations, the bus company that employed Mr. Redmond, did they do enough background check on him, given that he did have one OUI on his record? I did call them. They declined to comment on it. They referred it to a public relations firm in Boston who said that he was properly licensed. And what could have happened here, and although we're not sure, is that his OUI was, his first OUI was in 2008. He did, it was continued without a finding, so there was no conviction, which means in your job application, when you're asked if you've been convicted of a felony, if he said no, he was right, and the query check may have only gone back 5 years. So that's that's where they think that may have happened. But he's been fired.
Okay, let me ask you this: so was he apologetic when he spoke to the media, or was he just acknowledging, "Yes, I did this"?
No, he was very apologetic.
It's kind of refreshing in a way for someone to stand up there and say, "Yes, I did this and I apologize." It's so rare that you hear that.
It was. And he actually said when he's in, and he, this is what he said, "When I'm in better spirits, I would like to sit down with the parents to explain this because they didn't deserve this to happen."
Hmm. Now, I want to go back to what you said about Cape Destinations. So they're the contracted bus company that employed this gentleman.
Yes.
And so you ask them a good question. If you have a previous operating under the influence charge, does that preclude you as a job applicant for riding a bus for you? And they refer you to the PR firm. And the PR firm tells you, "We're not going to get into the company's hiring practice."
That's right. That's
I mean,
right.
That to me is like a very pertinent question that you think would be easily answerable.
Yeah, you would. You would. And actually, when you go on the Massachusetts Registry of Motor Vehicles website, it talks about the requirements for obtaining a school bus driver's license, a commercial driver's license. And one of them is a clean driving record.
Right.
So somebody, I would imagine, didn't look back far enough.
Well, it's an interesting PR tactic. We're not going to answer the most pertinent question of the day about one of our drivers being arrested with When students are in the...
That's right.
If I was a parent of one of these kids, I'd be out of my mind.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, interesting story. And let's talk about the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. And they are now, because they are a recognized nation by the federal government, they're now going to have more say in all sorts of things, but particularly they've signed an agreement regarding new road construction and transportation issues and such.
That's right. And as we know, the Wampanoags have been here in southern New England, primarily southeastern Massachusetts, for 12,000 years. And what happened on Monday was the first of its kind where a sovereign nation signed an agreement with state and federal transportation officials. So moving forward here on the Cape, as well as on the Vineyard, Nantucket, Bristol County, Plymouth County, Suffolk County, and parts of Middlesex and Worcester County, whenever there are any major highway projects that are about to begin, the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe will be consulted to make sure that none of the ancestral burial grounds or anything of cultural significance to the tribe are disturbed. Very, very important for the tribe. And they will be involved in the planning process as these projects move forward. And I should also note, I'm going to say a little more than a year ago, the town of Mashpee at its town meeting did vote for the planning board in Mashpee before any type of permit is issued for any type of building, construction, that an archaeological study be done to make sure that in the town of Mashpee, none of the burial grounds or any cultural artifacts are disrupted.
Hmm. And one of the representatives of the tribe was talking about the third bridge, a potential third traffic bridge. Of course, there are already mm-hmm. three bridges. One of them is for a railroad. So a third traffic bridge that's being considered, they would have a say in that as well.
They certainly would. And that was Ramona Peters, who was the tribe's historian. And that was very interesting that she mentioned that particular project because that certainly would be an area where there were likely to be something found.
Right, of course. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, Tim Wood is going to join us. Tim, of course, is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me is Jeff Spillane, and this is the News Roundup on WCAI. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI. We're discussing the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in the Woods Hole studio is Jeff Spillane, a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. Joining us on the phone is Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. So like many communities on Cape Cod, now we hear that Chatham is contemplating a plastic shopping bag ban.
Indeed. But unlike our neighbors in Harwich, for instance, which put a plastic bag ban in place through a citizen's petition at town meeting earlier this month, Chatham is looking to implement a ban through a health regulation. It may sound like a bit of a stretch, but the chairman of the Board of Health, Ted Whitaker, told us that he feels it's their job to safeguard both the community's health and the environment, and he feels the two are tied together, and plastic shopping bags, he said, are simply not good for the environment for a variety of reasons. They take decades to break down in landfills if they ever get there. They often end up as windblown litter and pollute the landscape. And statistics show that only about 5% of the plastic shopping bags that are distributed are actually recycled. A lot of them are reused, but few of them are recycled. Because mainly to do that, they have to be taken to usually a specific location, such as the store where they're distributed, because they can't be recycled in most towns' recycling centers. None of the buyers that the town sells its recyclables here in Chatham, for instance, will accept these plastic bags, according to the town's transfer station supervisor. Of course, another benefit of accomplishing a ban through health regulations is that it takes a public hearing and adoption by the board, and there doesn't have to be any town-wide vote. It's sort of the Board of Health has considerable regulatory power under state law. They have a bit of a bully pulpit, and in this case, they're going to use it. And at this point, the Health Board has just started to develop the regulations, and they say that they hope to have a measure in place in approximately 6 months.
Okay, and then let's move on. Jeff Splaine is here. We were talking about some of the results of different elections across Cape Cod. We'll talk about the islands in a bit as well. Harwich, let's talk about, there was a proposal to purchase some land that perhaps could be used for wastewater purposes in the future. How did that work out?
Sure. It didn't, is the short answer. A group called the NOON 9 Committee had organized after town meeting vote to purchase this 24 acres of land in East Harwich was approved. The neighbors felt that they weren't adequately informed. They organized, they put out signs, and they managed to defeat the question by almost a 3-to-1 margin on Tuesday's election. The vote was 650 in favor and 1,500 opposed. So they really struck a chord in town. And I think in Harwich, this played into an undercurrent that's been going on in town recently where there's been sort of a disillusion with the Board of Selectmen. And the other aspect of this is that voters also elected two new selectmen Tuesday, both of whom have little experience in town government. They're sort of coming from the outside. They both sort of campaigned on, you know, we're new, fresh air to come into the Board of Selectmen. Michael McCaskill won a one-year term, but he was unopposed. But newcomer Janelle Brown, she was facing a longtime Harwich volunteer who's on a number of committees named Matt Hart, and she pretty much tied herself to the vote no on 9 committee and helped that vote, I think, helped her get in. She won by a margin of more than 300 votes. And I think, like I said, this really plays into the disillusion and untrusting that a lot of people have of the Board of Selectmen in Harwich, and that sort of harkens back to last year's Route 124 paving proposal, where a grassroots initiative was able to overturn just an intent Board of Selectmen on having that that roadway repaved. People didn't want it. The selectmen wanted it, but people overturned them. So. And both Brown and McCaskill are relatively young. They both grew up in Harwich, graduated from Harwich High School, so they have deep roots in the community. And we'll be watching how their election really changes the dynamics of the Board of Selectmen, which, as an aside, is now going to have to decide how to move forward with wastewater disposal following the loss of that vote Tuesday.
Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. He joins us here each week on the News Roundup. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
You can follow Tim and the Chronicle on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. At CCC Newsroom is the Twitter handle there. Jeff Splaine is here from the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Continue talking about some of the news of the week. The Craigville Motel has been in the news for a few months now. That's a motel, right?
It is. It's a motel on Chute Flying Hill Road, right at exit 6 off of the Mid-Cape Highway. In fact, it's right across from the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce building.
Right.
The motel has been coming under fire from the town of Barnstable, Department of Health, as well as the building commissioner for about the past 2 years. The motel has been housing long-term residents for which it doesn't have a license. A motel license really is for transient motorists. That's what the description is. And there have also been several safety violations, fire code violations, you name it, and the motel owners have not been complying with the orders that the town of Barnstable has requested they comply with. And in April, they said, we are not renewing the motel license. You need to have all of your residents out of the motel by June 30th. The reason they selected June 30th was because there's actually families with children there. They didn't want to disrupt the school year. Mm-hmm. In some of the building commissioners and inspectors who had gone in there did see signs of people were living there for a long time. So there were fish tanks or large screen TVs, people cooking in there. It was very dangerous to be having all these appliances and things you need for everyday living in a hotel room. Now, yesterday there was a hearing at Barnstable Superior Court where the owners were trying to have an injunction placed against the town of Barnstable. That decision, they would like to be allowed to open at least 10 of their rooms for the tourist season, claiming that the Barnstable Board of Health went beyond its jurisdiction in closing the motel, as well as telling them that they had to get the people out by June 30th. Meanwhile, the town of Barnstable defended itself, and they had affidavits from several town managers, including the police chief, who said that the property was a chronic problem, that they had been called there 228 times in the past 18 months. And also the hotel is not sprinklered. So the judge is taking this under consideration. No idea when he'll come back with his decision, but it will be interesting to see what happens there.
If you're the Craigville Motel, it does seem like time is of the essence. With the motel closed, they could run into problems with their bank loan. Is that
correct? They certainly can. Santander Bank has already sent a letter to the owner, Jitendra Patel, saying that you are in violation of your note since you've lost your motel license. So that is an issue with them.
You covered a story this week related to an election and a dispute. It's now heading to court. Tell us about that.
It certainly is. And for those of you who don't know, Barnstable is a bit different than most towns on the Cape and in the state, for that matter, in that it has five fire districts that operated as their own organizations outside of the town. Auspices. And one of them is the West Barnstable Fire District. They had their election on April 29th. However, one of the candidates did not get her nomination papers in time to be checked by the town clerk and was disqualified. Nonetheless, her name appeared on the ballot. And there was a write-in candidate who said, geez, if nobody's running for this or she can't be on the ballot, I'll do it. And he, as well as several other people in the village of West Barnstable, were very surprised to see the name on the ballot. And there's been this argument, well, gee, you know, we're on our own. We don't need to have the town clerk take a look at our nomination papers. But it's been done historically since the elections began decades ago. So at a meeting last Wednesday night, the fire chief, West Barnstable fire chief, was also an attorney, did say that, you know, while we did have a series of errors here, there were several blunders made. First of all, the nomination papers were passed off to the fire district clerk at a party, and she was going to deliver them for this person, Crystal Lapine. There were quite a few mistakes, but we don't have it in our power to overturn the election or to say, let's do this election over. It would have to go to court. A judge would have to tell us to do this. And Donald Cox, who was a write-in candidate for the fire commissioner position on what they call the Prudential Committee, which is a governing authority of the fire district, said, well, if that's the case, I'm ready to go. And he's determined he is going to take this to court to see if they can overturn the election.
A lot of ins and outs with that one. I've never heard of such a thing. Okay. Well, I'm sure the courts will clear that right up. Jim DeRuta is on the phone, and he is the editorial page editor of the New Bedford Standard Times. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. And so tell us about this case of 15-year-old Malcolm Garcia. Is it Garcia?
Gracia. Yes. Malcolm was 15 when he was killed 3 years ago, almost to the day, in a confrontation with New Bedford police. He had been spotted on a police surveillance camera in one of the public housing areas, and they thought they'd seen him swapping a gang sign or a gang handshake. So they dispatched their anti-gang crew out to meet and greet, a term I think you're familiar with, or stop and frisk, they call it. And Malcolm took off, bolted. A police officer caught up with him, put his hands on his shoulders, and Malcolm turned around with a folding pocket knife, a really, really nasty-looking knife, and stabbed the officer three times. Malcolm, they tried to tase him. One of the prongs didn't connect, and he refused to drop the knife and continued to move toward police, so he was shot. He wasn't killed, and he tried to get up and move toward the police again, and then he was shot and killed. So there were no charges brought against police. The local NAACP worked closely with the police who got into the community and talked about it. And the issue was you know, came out a lot better than it than some of the police and African-American confrontations we've seen in the past couple years. But the family has filed a suit against the chief, the city, and five members of the force saying that Malcolm was targeted by racial and socioeconomic profile, that he was illegally stopped, and that that they want the city to end the policy of meet and greet or stop and frisk.
That's what they're suing for, to end that policy, or is there any monetary reward they're looking for? Award?
I haven't seen the suit, and we haven't done any reporting on that aspect, whether there's any monetary requests. But I know that they're attacking it on it being a discriminatory policy, and they want an end to it. There are counts alleging the wrongful taking of a life, negligence, lack of proper training. So I imagine there has to be a monetary component to it.
Let's move on to another story out of UMass Dartmouth, and this is a story you talked about a few weeks ago. It's related to the African Students Association there.
Yes, this is another story that has a tinge of racial bias and discrimination to it. It started out as a public safety issue. The group of the African Students Association at UMass was holding a sedan fundraiser on the campus, and they had planned a late-night after-party at a Swansea banquet facility called the Venus de Milo. There was a lingering concern from a member of the UMass Police Department that one of the members of the club had shared concerns about an alleged gang member from Boston from months earlier, but the remembering of that by the police officer raised his concerns, so he went to the police in Swansea, who went to the selectmen in Swansea, who went to the management of the Venus de Milo, and it was like a game of telephone where the story got a little more frightening each time it changed hands, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the university discovered this.
So the restaurant took action. They said, no, you can't have your event here.
They canceled it.
Right.
Now, the group had suggested they could pay for extra security. They had talked with the UMass Police Department, but through a number of dropped balls, it resulted in an unnecessary cancellation. So about 10 days after the event was canceled, it was held at UMass, and that created its own issues. But about 10 days after, in a regular meeting that the chancellor, Davina Grossman, holds with students called Shake the Ship, this issue was raised. The chancellor immediately appointed a vice chancellor for student affairs from UMass Boston, who is a former police chief and African American, to do a report that they could get out before the students left for the semester. And they've also planned a forum to deal with this issue specifically in the fall, but they realized it would take a lot longer to get this done. Now, UMass was very proactive and took the lead on this. It's well documented that, you know, white people think that race isn't as bad a problem as black people think racism is a problem. And, you know, the facts show that the black's perception is more accurate.
So that report hasn't come out. It should come out before the...
Nope. It's out.
It is out.
And it had several recommendations, like policies involving student events should be reviewed more carefully.
Mm-hmm.
Student club and organization advisors need to play stronger roles in assisting students with events, and that really would have prevented this confusion.
Yeah. Interesting stories, Jim. Thank you very much for sharing them with us. Jim DeRuta is the editorial page editor of the New Bedford Standard Times. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Sean.
And with me in our Woods Hole studio of Jeff Spillane, he's with the Cape Cod Times, where he is a reporter. And Jeff, let's talk about this assessment company. This is a company that I guess handles different testing data from the school districts, and we know there's a lot of testing data to handle these days. They've shut down, and
yes,
that's a problem.
Yes, it is an issue. It's actually a software company called ThinkGate, based in Charlotte, North Carolina, that had a product called Edwin Teaching and Learning, which quite a few school districts around the state were using. And here on the Cape, the largest school district, Barnstable, was the largest user of this particular package. The company had been in trouble. And product did, it had an online tool for student assessments that allowed administrators to measure student progress as well as test students. It had a data bank of questions that were very similar to what you'd see on the MCAS. And luckily, the administrators in Barnstable had about a 30-hour advance warning that this company may close. Mm-hmm. So they were able to get electronic and hard copy backup of the data and the records that they were storing there. Unfortunately, we understand that there are other school districts that weren't as lucky and lost their data.
Wow. So, what do they do now? Any ideas?
No idea what they can do now. Our reporter did call the company in Charlotte, and there was no answer.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and you're listening to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me is Jeff Spillane, and when we get back, Nelson Siegelman will join us, and he is the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Welcome back. This is the Local News Roundup on WCAI. We're discussing the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Jeff Spillane. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. On the phone, Nelson Siegelman. He's the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. You attended the Steamship Authority meeting, and they discussed quite a number of items there. Could you give us the lowdown?
Yes, just to correct you, I didn't attend it. We followed up on the meeting.
Okay, sure.
And yes, they had quite a bit going on. I think one item that is of some interest to folks who travel on the Steamship Authority on a regular basis is the Wi-Fi service. In the past, it could be really intermittent, and needless to say, it would be very frustrating. You have that 45-minute time period. You think you're going to perhaps do some work or do some shopping or just surf the web, and all of a sudden you would lose the Wi-Fi signal. But Mary Claffey, who's in charge of IT at the Steamship Authority, gave a report at the Steamship Authority meeting and said that she thinks they've dramatically improve Wi-Fi service by upgrading the technology on the boats, and hopefully that's the case, and I think people will certainly be happy to be able to click onto the World Wide Web while they're traveling.
Right. Another issue they discussed was smoking, and I think they're talking about the employees.
Yes, I found this sort of interesting. People who are familiar with the Steamship Authority, it's not unusual to see an employee smoking. And, of course, at the same time, you're hearing announcements while you're on the boat that there's no smoking allowed anywhere on the boats. And now they've included that to the on-ramp. But the employees are, in fact, allowed to smoke, but they're not allowed to smoke, and I'm quoting now, they're prohibited from smoking while performing their duties, and they then list the various duties. And in a follow-up email, General Manager Wayne Lampson said that they can smoke on steamship property, but I guess pretty much they have to do it out of sight of passengers and while not interacting with passengers, but there are no specific smoke breaks. We did check with the Washington State Ferry Service, and in fact, they don't allow their employees to smoke anytime, anywhere, break or no break. So it's an interesting work rule, to say the least.
And it came about because someone, I guess, had complained?
Yes, a passenger complained that they saw employees smoking. And,
right. Okay.
You know, as I say, if people who travel on it regularly, I'm sure that came as no surprise. It's a little bit like gambling at Rick's Cafe. So, but you know.
I don't know what that means.
You need to see the movie Casablanca.
Oh, okay. I guess I do. I didn't know if Rick's Cafe was on Martha's Vineyard.
No. I wish it were. It'd be a very interesting place.
Let's talk about this. You have a story about a gated equestrian community that they're attempting to build?
Yes, this is a really, interesting story, and I've been following it for a long time, but it sort of came from a period I like to describe as the golf course wars. But at a certain point, three different developers arrived on Martha's Vineyard with dreams of building golf courses. One of them was this fellow, Corey Coopersmith. He wanted to build a golf course in Oak Bluffs. There was a chunk of property that had been for sale for about 10 years called Webb's Campground. Suddenly, when golf course developers eyed that property, a number of vineyards marshaled their forces to try and defeat it, and under the sort of bumper sticker, Save Webb's Campground. At any rate, Corey Coopersmith and his group eventually acquired almost 300 acres in an area called the Southern Woodlands. They ran up against the Martha's Vineyard Commission, our regional planning and permitting agency, which turned down his proposal. There are a number of legal battles involved. Ultimately, Corey Coopersmith agreed to sell a big chunk of his property to the Martha's Vineyard Land Bank for about $18 million with the condition that he'd be allowed to retain 90 acres and create this equestrian development. But he ran into a number of different problems, personal problems, and ultimately this is dragged on. The development was never created. He's in bankruptcy, and here comes the patent companies, a large national development company with quite a record. I found it quite interesting looking at them on the web, and they've bought the note from the bank, and now they're planning next month to either sell it or develop it. So it will be the last chapter in Corey Coopersmith's dream, and we'll see what happens. Obviously, 90 acres of subdivided land on Martha's Vineyard is pretty valuable.
And where do the horses come into play?
Well, I think the horses have left the barn on this one, because although it was supposed to be an equestrian development, the person who purchases the property, they're under no obligation to have horses, goats, or any other kind of animal. But they will receive basically 20 lots in this 90-acre subdivision and be able to do with it what they will. When I took a look at the property last week, they have a very large really crater in the middle of it, which was intended to be a pond. So it's a really lovely piece of property, and hopefully whoever purchases it or whatever becomes of it, it will be a nice addition to the vineyard.
Nelson, we have if you have a couple more minutes, maybe
sure.
You could tell us about the story you did about the dam. I found it really interesting.
Well, this is the Mill Pond Dam in West Tisbury, and it was put in really as a, just as it says, for a mill, and now it has created a small pond, which is the subject of some discussion in West Tisbury about whether or not the dam should be removed. At any rate, I went there last week and met Brad Chase, who's a biologist for the Division of Marine Fisheries. There had been herring trying to get in there, and while we were there, Brad reached into the sand and came up with a glass eel. They're also called elvers. It was about maybe 2 inches long, but the remarkable thing is that elver began its journey in the Sargasso Sea thousands of miles away. It had floated in the ocean currents, come through the cut at the and made its way up Tisbury Gray Pond, and there it was, clambering, shimmering, shimmying up the side wall of this dam. And I just thought it was really a remarkable thing to witness, and was able to get a little video clip of it that folks can see on our website. But it's really neat. And these American eels are, in fact, close to being listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. And dams, of course, don't help the situation, and communities across Massachusetts and throughout New England and the country are seeing the wisdom of dam removal and stream connectivity, and for my part, I hope that occurs here.
And we have seen some stories here on Cape Cod related to poaching of those eels.
Yes, they're remarkably valuable in the Asian market. They one piece I read said that they've gone for as high as $2,000 a pound, if you can imagine that. And the demand in the Asian market is so high that first they went to Europe and pretty much wiped out that eel population, and now they've turned their sights here. And with the price so high, poaching is a real problem. I know that on the Cape they've arrested some people. In fact, when I was speaking with Brad Chase, he was telling me about one herring run where the poachers had left their car or their truck and their nets and run away. The environmental police almost had them. And, you know, it's a sort of one of those terrible stories where you have these poachers who basically can wipe out one generation of these already threatened creatures. So,
yeah, it's despicable.
Money, you know.
Money. Nelson Sigelman is the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hope you enjoy this nice weekend, Nelson.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to it.
Great. Thank you. Jeff Spillane is here. This, of course, is the News Roundup on WCAI, and Jeff Spillane is a reporter at the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, let's return to the this issue of opiate abuse. It's a major problem, of course, here on the Cape and the Islands. A grand jury has indicted a Hyannis doctor.
Yes, that happened last week as well. It's Dr. Mohammed Nasseri, who is affiliated with a pediatric neurology clinic in Hyannis. He was indicted on 11 counts of illegally prescribing narcotics, as well as filing bogus mass health claims. And this was a result of an investigation by the Attorney General's office. And the new Attorney General, Maura Healey, has made this a priority since she's come into office in January. And as a matter of fact, she paid a visit to the Cape Cod Times about 3 weeks ago and did talk about this as being one of her priorities, and also said, you know, four out of five heroin users begin with these prescriptions. So it is a big issue for her that she is going to tackle. Now, Dr. Nasseri, it appears, was prescribing oxycodone and Percocet to patients who already had documented substance abuse issues. And he was trying to cover this up, allegedly, by asking for urine tests to be done before he prescribed this to see if the patients had been using drugs. But that was just a cover-up, and in a lot of cases it wasn't done. And when he did bill MassHealth, he used a billing code that was more in line with a regular physical-type checkup. He did surrender his medical license last week.
And these, of course, are allegations, and so he's been indicted by a grand jury, mm-hmm. so presumably it could go to trial.
That's right.
Let's move to a story in the town of Bourne, where they had a tough decision to make. Will they join the MBTA? This was really controversial because it's from the reporting in the Cape Cod Times, it was unclear whether joining the MBTA would really be a benefit at this time.
That's right. There were questions about joining the MBTA, whether or not Bourne, without receiving any MBTA service right now, would have to pay its dues. And it does not right now because it's already paying, from what I can understand, regional transportation dues with the Cape Cod Regional Transit Authority, et cetera. But the voters did, and when they went to the polls on Tuesday, voted for the town of Bourne to join the MBTA. And many people are looking at this as a first step for bringing commuter rail to Buzzards Bay. And Bourne will become a member of the MBTA starting in January 2016, just like most towns and municipalities in the greater Boston area. When you take a look at the towns that belong to the MBTA, I'm sure that Bourne is the southernmost.
Let's talk about Heritage Museum and Gardens. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they have opened a new aerial park. It opened this past weekend.
It did.
It was controversial. Neighbors were not too happy with that going in at all.
Not at all. And you're right. It did open last weekend. They had 140 visitors on the first weekend. And what would a week be, Sean, without talking about some controversy?
Well, now that we can't talk about Heritage. Cape Wind every week, we apparently have turned to Heritage Museum and Gardens.
That's right. Now, two neighbors near Heritage are seeking criminal complaints, saying that the plans for the zip line in the aerial park actually, what we see now there, strayed from the original plans, and they are suing seeking this complaint as a result of what they can do with the Old Kings Highway District Committee, which is which oversees what happens along Route 6A. And the issue at hand here with these neighbors is two yurts, which were part of the plan, apparently are not located where they were supposed to be. Meanwhile, Heritage says, hey, we're in compliance with this, with the plan, but these two neighbors certainly don't think so. So it's going to be interesting to see where that goes. Also, another little bit of controversy with Heritage this week. Heritage received $1 million in state funding for parking lot and road improvements, I should say. They haven't used that, and so there is an amendment that has been filed by the new state senator, Vinny DiMaceto, allowing the Heritage to carry over some of that funding into the next year for their road improvements. Obviously, they're not going to be able to get that done in, by the time that the fiscal year ends. But there is our reporter, George Brennan, did find an interesting relationship here that former Senator Therese Murray's district director, Lance Lambros, is now working for Senator DiMaceto, whose brother is working on the construction project for Heritage. So it does seem as if there may have been, if you connect the dots there, that there may have been a possibility of something going on. Now, Heritage, as well as the senator's office, are completely denying that and saying there's nothing.
Sure. It's supposition at this point.
That's right.
In the town of Falmouth, there was a few weeks ago, town meeting, big debate about a joint dispatch center. That would be a dispatch center that would serve both the police and the fire departments, right? They wanted to put it in a community building.
They did. They wanted to put it in the Gus Canty community building.
And the reason they wanted to put it in the community building is because they didn't want to show any favoritism. It seemed, this is what was said.
A neutral site. A neutral site.
Okay.
And it would also be the dispatch center for the DPW and Marine Services as well. So that did get voted down at that town meeting. But they did say, here, take a look at the fire station, the third floor of the fire station. But now the Board of Selectmen has given the okay for Falmouth to look at the fire station as well as the police department for this consolidated dispatch center, and they have given the go-ahead to hire an architect and a telecommunications firm to take a look at the possibility of doing it at one of these locations. And, of course, the factors, the big driving factors for this consolidated dispatch center is for savings and personnel and equipment to have it all consolidated in one place.
Memorial Day weekend, traffic. All these issues, it's going to be quite a weekend here. Beautiful weather.
It is. A kickoff to summer. Here we go.
A kickoff to summer. It's so interesting. We know at the end of the summer, people from Cape Cod will gather by the bridges and wave as people leave. I wonder if they greet them as well when they arrive.
I haven't seen that. although I can tell you, in just coming here this morning, there certainly are a lot more cars on the road than there have been in the past few days.
Absolutely. Things are livening up here
The Cape Cod Times newsroom, Hyannis has been buzzing over the past few days. I just noticed it leaving last night.
Nantucket is certainly much busier. I was there on this past weekend, and of course, they had the wine festival as well.
Right.
So things are kicking up. Well, Jeff Spillane, you're a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. Thank you very much for coming in and discussing the news with us. I also want to thank, of course, the other participants, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim DeRuta of the New Bedford Standard Times, and Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. If you know a local journalist that you'd like to hear on the News Roundup on WCAI, have them get in touch with me. They can contact me here at the station or via Twitter, at Corcoran WCAI. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.
The Friday News Roundup on The Point is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.